science lovers, welcome to Hooked on Science. I'm your host, Julia Cubans, and this is a podcast where we learn about cool research that you should know about. As far as podcast news right now, I wanted to give a little update about my annual goal for 2021, which, if you didn't hear or you don't remember, was to have a play in all 50 US states. And as of right now, Sunday, October 10th, 8 p.m., Hooked on Science has been downloaded or played in 37 states, which is crazy. And also, just for funsies, it has also been played in 33 countries, which is, well, honestly, I'm speechless. It is so cool to see that my little podcast has had, you know, some reach across the globe. So I want to thank each and every one of you listening now. It's really encouraging to see people listening, so I appreciate you tuning in. And whether or not you're subscribed or if you listen regularly, I'm happy to have you here. And also, when I see people listening in like Brazil or Greece, I know that it's not just my family listening to the show to make me feel better, unless they have a very complicated VPN scheme, which I don't think is the case. But, you know, just having other real actual people listening, that's awesome. So thanks for tuning in, and I hope that you will continue on this journey learning about, well, you know, everything with me. So yeah, thank you again. Today's guest is Emily Schaefer, who is a PhD student at Northwestern studying biomedical engineering. She is also the creator and one of the hosts of In the Spotlight, which is a podcast with a very similar premise to Hooked on Science. We'll get more into that during the episode, so I'm not gonna belabor that too much right now, but I do want to mention that today's episode is a crossover episode. And what does that mean for a podcast? Well, like maybe a TV show you've watched before. That means that while Emily is a guest on Hooked on Science today, I am also a guest on In the Spotlight for the episode that was also released today. The link to that is in the episode notes, so you better go check it out. But first, let's hear from Emily about her research. Hi, Emily. Welcome to Hooked on Science. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you so much, Julia, for doing this crossover with me. I'm so excited to talk more about my work.
Yeah. And so I guess before we even get started, I would like to mention Emily, our wonderful guest today, is also a podcast host, and her podcast has a very similar premise to Hooked on Science. So you'll probably like it. And if you want to check it out, it's called In the Spotlight. I guess, Emily, do you want to give like a short little plug before we get started to promote it?
Yeah, totally. Like Julia said, if you're a avid listener of Hooked on Science, I'm guessing you would love In the Spotlight as well. In the Spotlight is all about interviewing graduate students and early career researchers in the sciences about their work and really understanding why everybody else should care about it. Why should non-scientists and the rest of society really care about your work or know about your work? And so we try to ask more of the big picture questions. What are the problems you're trying to solve? How does it relate to news and policies and things that we might experience in our daily life? And it leads to some really great conversations about some very fascinating parts of science. So our season two, well, by the time this is actually released, season two will have started, which I'm very excited about. So please check us out. And I should mention too that Julia is a guest on In the Spotlight this week. These episodes are coming out at the same time. So if you're really curious about Julia's work, you should pop over to In the Spotlight and check out the episode.
Yeah. So after you listen to this, you already have your next podcast episode queued up. Maybe. Hopefully.
Hopefully. Hopefully I made the sale.
So I think when we were recording for In the Spotlight last week, you asked me a question that I used to ask my guests every time they came on the show, and I kind of fell out of it, but I'd like to ask you, when did you know you wanted to be a scientist?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I love getting people's responses to this, but I feel like my answer is pretty stereotypical, pretty boring. Like, I started out as a young kid being just really fascinated by a lot of different parts of science. And like a lot of, you know, kids, I bounced around in a lot of different topics within science that really intrigued me. So I remember as like a 8-year-old just loving dolphins. And I said, I want to be a marine biologist. And then 2 years later, I would go to a summer camp and I thought, oh my gosh, mechanical engineering is the coolest thing I've ever heard of. I want to go design roller coasters. And then by the time high school rolled around, it was astronomy. And I was like, I'm going to do something with space because this is absolutely incredible. And so it took me a really long time to really find a home within science. But it was pretty obvious from an early age that I just loved science, the ways of thinking that come with science, the fact that it can be really, really hands-on, all of those things just really spoke to me.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. As we talked about last week, for myself, I had a similar kind of trajectory of being like, oh, this is cool, this is cool, maybe this is cool. I don't like this so much now that I tried it out. Let's bounce to something else. So it's always, I don't know, nice to hear people talk about, you know, not being sure right off the bat, because I do know people, and I've talked to people that are like, I always knew I wanted to be a mechanical engineer. Like, my partner, he is a mechanical engineer, and I was like, well, what did you want to be when you grew up? And he was like, mechanical engineer. It's like, I do not have that that experience.
Yeah, by the time I got to college, I kind of became that weirdo, because I was the weirdo that never changed majors. I came in as a biomedical engineer and I stuck it out and I graduated as a biomedical engineer. And now I'm in a biomedical engineering graduate program. So in that respect, I guess I was a little bit more focused on one path, I guess. But I did add a major. I did add neuroscience when I was in my undergrad. So that was like a fun new twist.
Well, it sounds like a combination of things that maybe most people wouldn't normally think of as a career path when they're younger, or maybe even starting college, and also a combination that sounds like a lot of really hard coursework, honestly.
One of the interesting parts about biomedical engineering specifically is that you really become that jack of all trades, master of none in some respect, because as a BME, you're just expected to have a strong understanding of so many different types of science. You have to be an engineer by trade that can, you know, code things and build things and do all of that stuff. But then you also have to know biology inside and out. And you also have to know chemistry and physics and all those basic sciences. And so you have your hand in a lot of different pots as a BME.
What is biomedical engineering? I think maybe people like myself might have a kind of vague understanding about what that means, but what is it?
Great question. I am sometimes still trying to figure that out. It's vague. The reason that people can have a vague understanding is because BME is so broad, like you're saying. Because, you know, you become this jack of all trades, it means that people can specialize in a lot of different things and still call themselves a biomedical engineer. But at the end of the day, BME just very loosely means any time that you're using technology or some sort of engineering practices to solve biological and medical problems. Mm-hmm. And so the stereotypical example I like to give is like robots doing surgery, those sorts of things where we're taking what we know about engineering or what we're building and applying them to medical problems. All of that falls under biomedical engineering.
Okay, very interesting. So, I mean, you mentioned that growing up you wanted to, you know, study dolphins or study astronomy, but both of those are pretty different from biomedical engineering. How did you end up there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think at the end of the day, I was pretty certain I wanted to be in engineering because I liked the hands-on problem-solving aspect, mm-hmm. and I didn't want to lose that at all. But I also really was intrigued by biology, and kind of related to that as well, I loved biology, but knew that I would not be happy in medical school. I could not see myself being a doctor that practices medicine and sees patients and all that sort of stuff. And so biomedical engineering just happened to be that buzzword that fell into my lap. And before I even realized what biomedical engineering really was, I kind of felt sold on it just because of, you know, those two facts alone.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that you mentioned, you know, going into some, like, medical school as an option that you wouldn't have liked. I feel like maybe you've heard this on In the Spotlight as well, but I've had a number of guests who have talked about how, you know, they wanted to be a doctor and that's like what they wanted to be. And then they realized they couldn't do the blood or they couldn't, you know, something was just a bad fit about medical field. And then they're like, well, now I'll go into, I think two of my guests who have done that, one went into the plant sciences. It was just the episode that came out last week, and one that works still in medical research, but, you know, not in the patient care side of things. Right. But it's just, it seems maybe many of us have a high achieving, like, we could go to medical school, but it's like, no, we'll go to other doctor school, PhD doctor school instead.
PhD doctor school. Yeah, I think I could have, realistically, I could have done medical school. It wasn't that I was, like, terrified of blood or something like that, but more so that I just couldn't see myself seeing patients. Mm-hmm. I thought at the end of the day, like, if I'm going to put all of that work into all of this stuff about medicine and biology and the things that really intrigued me, I just wasn't really excited by the idea of ending up in a job where I was seeing patients. I wanted to still be in that, you know, researchy, sciencey mindset of problem solving and exploring new technologies and all that sort of stuff. So biomedical engineering just happened to be the really happy medium for me.
Nice. So you mentioned that biomedical engineering is a hugely broad field. What specifically do you work on within biomedical engineering?
Yeah, so the subfield, I would call it, that I work in is called bioelectronics. Okay. And it's not a phrase that's really made it into mainstream public understanding yet, but you can kind of get a little bit of a sense just from the parts of the word itself. You're combining biology with some traditional electronics and stuff thrown in. And so we have a lot of different people represented within bioelectronics. You have more, you know, biology expertise, then you have electronics expertise, and then kind of the dark horse, the glue that's holding us all together, is more of the chemistry and material science, actually, that's pretty heavily represented within bioelectronics as well. But why and how are we putting all of these different disciplines together, right?
Yeah, these that's are a lot. I was just going to ask, do you do all those things or is this a big team effort?
It is a big team effort. With biomedical engineering and especially bioelectronics, you're pulling people with tons of different backgrounds and expertise. So I can give my lab even as an example. My PI has a background in material science, and that's what all of his training was in. You know, I'm a biomedical engineer by training with some neuroscience expertise as well. I have lab mates and postdocs that come from electrical engineering, that are in chemistry, that, you know, are more so on the applications and the biology side. And everybody's coming together to make any bioelectronics project work.
Yeah. So bioelectronics seems like, obviously, it sounds like electronics and the human body. You were saying that already. But what might we need what do we need bioelectronics for?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Everything.
There's a lot of everything. That's a great answer. Everything.
The way your face looked was kind of like a, okay, how do I take this and distill it down?
There's a lot of instances already that we can think of where we're putting medical devices, and specifically medical devices that have electrical components, into your body, and some of which people are already really familiar with, things like pacemakers or, you know, wearable sensors or even electrodes and devices on the brain. All of those sorts of things are happening now. But the gold standard of all of those devices is making them primarily of metal. And that comes with a lot of potential problems that people might not realize. Most importantly, metal is very rigid. It's very inflexible. And people maybe don't realize that one of the ways that your body recognizes something as foreign when it's implanted is simply through its mechanical compliance. So your cells and your tissue and your organs are really soft. And then metal is very hard and rigid and inflexible. And so it creates this really destructive mechanical mismatch where your cells can just automatically recognize that as foreign and will just attack it. And so even in the best case scenario, when you're implanting devices like this, you get tons of typical inflammation and scar tissue buildup, and downstream that'll affect things like device performance. So it's not going to operate as well as it should. And you probably can't leave it in your body as long as you might want to. You might need to get it replaced, or it can't be used at all in long-term applications. And in the worst case scenario, you're getting things like infection and rejection of the device and these really extreme outcomes that might endanger the patient. And so the question is, how do we make this entire category of devices better? And we can make these devices better and mitigate all of these problems related to using metals by introducing new materials, specifically polymers. And there's this really interesting class of materials that we call conducting polymers. And they're able to conduct electricity just like a metal can, but they're soft and compliant. And so now if we're making these devices out of polymers, specifically these conducting polymers, they're bound to elicit less of an immune response because they are matching the mechanical properties mm-hmm. of the tissue around it. In our world, we call that biocompatible. That might be a phrase that people have heard before. They're generally going to be more stable, and so they can be used for long-term applications. And in a lot of instances, they can even be more sensitive or just higher performing than purely metal devices as well.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. So I guess maybe this is a bigger question than I think it is, but what is a polymer? Like, is there something in our day-to-day life that would be like, oh yeah, that thing you use all the time, this is a polymer, and then we're just making, you know, other versions of it to put inside people's bodies or on people's bodies?
Yeah, that's a good question. Polymers are around you far more than you realize.
Okay.
They're the plastics that we're using, you know, plastic bags and Tupperware and all sorts of things. They're also in a lot of industrial materials. Anything where you hear the buzzword that has a poly in front of it, that's a polymer.
Okay.
And so polymers, you know, it's this really wide-reaching class. And a lot of times polymers are advantageous because they're relatively inert and they still maintain this like soft compliance. But that's what makes these conducting polymers even more unique and cool, is that they have this ability to conduct electricity, and now it just opens up a huge number of doors that we can explore using these polymers for beyond just our typical plastics that we might see in our daily life.
Yeah, so, I mean, that makes it sound like, you know, polymers have been around for a long time, if that's the case, and we've been using them for a long time. How long have we, or I guess you, people in your field, been trying to introduce polymers and these conducting polymers into medical devices, I guess?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have an answer off the top of my head, but it's more of like a matter of decades than, say, centuries or whatever. I think if I remember correctly, one of the Nobel Prizes was given to the discovery of conducting polymers, and I want to say it was in like the late 70s, maybe something like that, that discovery was initially made. So we've had it for a few decades now, but I would say in general the field is just really blossoming and really exploding. A lot of people are working more on the materials side, like I alluded mm-hmm. to before. We have to develop and optimize the materials themselves, and so a lot of chemists and material scientists are working hard to create new polymers that have the properties that we need them to have, that they're stable, that they're able to conduct electricity, that they're, you know, have a really fast time response for certain applications. They're very biocompatible and all sorts of things that we want them to have. And then there's people like me that are more on the application side and trying to take the polymers that people have already vetted and created and try and see what sort of applications we can use them in and really improve things like medical devices.
Okay, so with that, what kind of applications can we use them in?
Yeah, that's a good natural question next, right? You know, I'm personally the most interested in neural applications. Mm-hmm. So I can speak to that probably the best. I think, you know, anything that touches the brain is to me super duper fascinating. From a personal standpoint, that's part of what really attracted me to bioelectronics. You know, I like neuroscience, and there are a lot of labs that are doing very hardcore neuroscience work where they're studying the brain in these animal models or in different cell models and all sorts of wonderful things. But if you think about it, those labs that are doing neuroscience research, the data that they collect and the conclusions that they're coming to are only as good as the tools that they have at their disposal.
Sure.
And so to me, bioelectronics is just coming at it from a tools angle. And I want to be, you know, contributing to this field of neuroscience and have an impact just simply through the tools that are at their disposal and are, you know, advancing other fields like neuroscience.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say too, as far as like more broadly other applications as well, I can just, again, use my lab as an example. We have people that do like more sensor development, and that can be implantables and wearables, that can be electrophysiology and just like more hardcore circuitry and how we're sensing electrical signals in the brain. Or it can even be regenerative engineering. And so the scaffolds that we use to regrow tissue in the body, you know, if those organs are electroactive, if they're used to conducting some sort of electrical signals in the body, then it stands to reason that the scaffold that we use to regrow that tissue should also be electroactive. And so we're able to infuse these conducting polymers into scaffolding as well. And so there's a really wide range of potential applications that conducting polymers can be used in.
Okay. Yeah. I'm trying to soak this all in and
soak it in.
Formulate a next question. So, okay. One thing that I was going to ask you is if your neuroscience background came into play in what you're doing now, and it sounds like it is, as well as your biomedical engineering background. So that's very cool. But within that, and like combined with what you were just talking about, what is your kind of specific research question? Because I mean, it sounds like there are just a broad variety of applications within this field. How do you narrow that down, and what do you work on?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I work more in biosensor development. That's what's most exciting to me. And so what that means, biosensors can be sensing a whole slew of different molecules that are present in your body. And so conducting polymers, like I've said, we can use them for things like electrophysiology, for measuring electrical signals. And there's a lot of people that are working on that sort of stuff. They stick the conducting polymer on an electrode or a transistor or whatever it is. They're sensing electrical activity. That's really being optimized right now.
Okay.
But the neat thing about biosensors, or especially biochemical sensors, is we take those electrodes with the conducting polymer that people have already been working on, and we slap on a recognition element, is kind of what we call it, and now all of a sudden that electrode is sensitive to one specific target molecule that might be in your body.
Okay.
Obviously, it's a lot more complicated than that. And, you know, the decision of what recognition element you're doing and how you attach it and how that translates into the types of signals that you're getting. There's a lot of different layers to all of this, mm-hmm. but it just makes the sensor selective to things like neurotransmitters or proteins or cytokines or ions or whatever it is that you're interested in. And so I'm working on finding new ways of functionalizing these conducting polymers specifically for sensing applications.
Okay. So that is a far cry from, you know, what I do out in the crop fields. So what does your day-to-day look like in this research?
You know, my day-to-day is a interesting mix of, you know, kind of these more traditional wet lab techniques and practices with electronics and electrochemical techniques. And all of this comes together into a wonderfully chaotic mess. As you can imagine, we have a lot of different disciplines represented. We have a lot of different collaborations going on. It takes a lot of people just to make one project happen. But I'm more so than you, Julia. I'm kind of in a traditional lab at a bench, pipetting things, sticking cables on and all sorts of stuff. That's kind of what you picture, I guess.
Yeah, so if we took like a stock photo of scientist, we might see, be able to put it like side by side with a picture of you in the lab.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Nice. When you're developing these, when you're looking at it to think, okay, I wanna target this certain neurotransmitter, I wanna know if it's picking up these electrical signals, how do you know that it's working and doing the thing that you want it to?
Medical devices, like a lot of other technologies or drugs or whatever it is, go through a lot of different stages of testing. And so I'm pretty early in the pipeline of developing new sensors. All of the tests and, you know, creating that I'm doing is all on a benchtop. For me, testing if things are working is by just exposing different sensors or different platforms to the molecule of interest directly. And maybe you're running all sorts of other tests too to make sure that it's sensitive enough, that it's able to detect at low enough limits or low enough concentrations of the molecule that it's going to be useful. Maybe you're testing that it's selective enough and that if you put in similar neurotransmitters or molecules that have very similar structures, that it's not going to sense those and think that that's your target of interest. So there's a lot of different, you know, metrics that we have to quantify before we even think about taking it to an animal model.
When you're thinking about testing these and seeing if it can pick up a certain neurotransmitter at a low level or whatever concentration, do you just have like bottles of neurotransmitter liquid? I don't know. How does that work?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. It seems kind of funny, but you can literally, if you work in a research lab and you're purchasing from research companies, you can buy a bottle of dopamine. You can buy a bottle of serotonin. It is not like the drugs that you get for mental health reasons or whatever. It's definitely not the same. I get a kick out of the fact that people, it's just become normal in like memes and mainstream culture to be like, ah, yes, I need some serotonin today. Cause I'm like, I just literally have a bottle of serotonin here. But yeah, I mean, when you're testing lots of molecules of interest, things like cytokines, like I said, proteins, ions, whatever it is, typically you're putting them in solution. So in a research lab like mine, we're using solutions, kind of like a saline, like a salt solution that's supposed to pretty closely mimic the salt solutions that would be present in your body. And you're just dissolving these molecules that you would care about in that and spiking or dosing your sensor with that.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And it is kind of funny to think that you just have a bottle of serotonin or whatever lying around, but,
For the science, right? Mm-hmm. It gets especially funny when you talk about, my lab doesn't do this, but there are definitely other groups that are working in the biosensor space that are trying to detect, I'm not sure what the right word is, trying to detect more sensitive compounds, maybe is a good way of putting it. So things like cocaine is a kind of common drug to be targeting in a system. And thank goodness we don't do that, because I don't want to jump through all the logistical and red tape of having just cocaine sitting in the lab.
But I can't even imagine.
Right? There's definitely more extreme examples, even more extreme than just dopamine or serotonin.
Yeah, for sure. So with all of this, what are you hoping to see at the end of your projects? Where does this go? Because it sounds like there are a lot of different avenues that this could take. Is there something specific that at the end of the day you're saying, yes, I want to target this. I want this sensor to be better for this application?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And as someone who's like, a little over halfway through grad school, I'm in that like really jaded phase. It can be kind of hard to answer, but I'll do my best.
Sure.
I think biochemical sensing for neural applications, as I've kind of already alluded to, is what fascinates me the most. But obviously, even within that, there's a lot of different directions and potential. And so I'm working on these like isolated different types of sensors that are using different recognition elements and different sensing modalities and whatever. I think what would be coolest is to eventually be able to design these larger scale devices that are combining biochemical sensors and electrodes and transistors that are doing electrophysiology. Mm-hmm. And so you can imagine we're getting really, really good at making neural devices that you put in your brain. You might see even groups like this is a fun fact. Just going to interject in the middle of this explanation. Elon Musk's Neuralink actually uses the same conducting polymer that I use.
Nice.
So even Elon Musk thinks that conducting polymers are cool.
This is important and cool.
This is important news. but, you know, all that to say is that we're getting really good at making devices. We're making electrodes that are super duper small, that are really, really high performing, that are very stable in your brain. Obviously, there's always room to grow, but that field is really progressing really quickly. And you can imagine that if there are people working on the biochemical sensors too, we can just kind of tag those on to the same devices that are doing the electrical recordings. And all of a sudden, there's this potential for multimodal recordings where we can measure neurotransmitters and electrical signals at the same mm-hmm. time. I think that would be so cool.
So once you kind of develop that technology and you're saying, okay, this is ready to roll out and be used in neuroscience for patients, for research, whatever it is, to be used on humans, what is that process like? Is that something where you like make a patent and then sell it to whoever, or do you sell it to a company? How does that work?
That's a wonderful question that I'm terribly sorry that I'm not going to be able to answer very well, but I will do my best. There are certainly groups, as academic researchers, a lot of times we think in terms of just research papers, but if you're creating new devices and new sensors and whatever it is, a lot of times you're applying for patents as well. But what you do with those patents can be completely up to you. There are definitely labs at Northwestern where I'm at, where they've created spin-off companies where they can mm-hmm. take something that they created from a grant in a research project and really run with it on their own. But I'm sure there are also certainly cases where people are selling ideas. And I'm sure there are also cases where things just go unnoticed, unfortunately, and might just stay in academic circles. So you like to think that the devices and cool research that has the best potential is getting there, but there's definitely still a need to be thinking about the link between academic research and companies and who's really translating that to applications where it makes a difference.
Okay. Yeah. So it sounds like there's not just one pipeline that people are using to get from point A to point B.
Right. It's a very convoluted path is what I've gathered from my experience.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. That seems like just the way that research is always a convoluted path, unfortunately.
Oh, isn't it always?
So studying neuroscience and biomedical engineering, this is all good and fun, but you are also involved in a podcast, In the Spotlight, at Northwestern. How did In the Spotlight come to be?
Yeah, I was the one that conceived of In the Spotlight, which is kind of cool to say. I feel like starting a podcast is like a bucket list thing. So I was I was sitting around twiddling my thumbs all throughout isolation, just being like, okay, I need some ways to spend my time, first of all. But I also felt a nagging responsibility that I needed to be doing more to share science with my communities. And this kind of comes back to a bigger picture concept that it's taken me some time to really formulate my thoughts on, but In the Spotlight has just come from this idea this really strong belief that I've developed that as scientists, now more than ever, we have a responsibility to make science as accessible to and impactful for our local communities. And academic research, as you know, Julia, is very challenging. It's gotten really cutthroat over time. And as researchers, it's really easy to keep your head down and stay in your lane and only focus on your work and do what you need to do to be what researchers judge as a successful scientist, you know, write papers and get grants and all that sort of stuff. But I mean, the COVID-19 pandemic has made it so abundantly clear that the connections between scientists and non-scientists are not nearly as strong as we thought they were. And scientists need to be acting very intentionally to maximize the impact of their work on society. And one of those ways is through science communication. That's why I fell in love with practicing science communication and doing things like a podcast. I mean, the reality is that not every project that you do in the lab is going to revolutionize something or lead to some incredible solution. So what can we do as individuals? We can try to reach out to non-scientists or other members of our community that we think need to be learning from science. And so engaging the public with science and sharing science is a way that we all can contribute. And so I really hope to be, you know, more of an advocate for science outside of just my network of scientists and peers, and really help make sure that people realize that science is here to benefit everyone, but it's not going to happen just on its own. We have to work intentionally that science can really get there and have the impact that it needs to have.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think Hooked on Science was conceived out of, you know, some similar thoughts of being like, we're doing all this research and maybe not everything I'm doing is super cool and awesome, but there are so many people doing super cool and awesome things that if I put out a podcast episode every single day, I could never cover the cool and awesome things that people are talking about. And it gets stuck in this such a bubble, and it seems like it never leaves. Science, I think in many fields is, you know, people only look at the science that's directly relevant to what they're doing, and they need to use as a citation for something or what have you. But I think, yeah. I think it's really great that there are, you know, both you and I, and then lots of other different people have come to these same conclusions about science communication, and hopefully using podcasts to connect science with, I think, both non-scientists and scientists in other disciplines.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you hit the nail on the head. There's so much science out there. There's so many interesting things that are happening. So also, just from like a selfish standpoint, it's really fun to hear about what else is going on in the worlds of science and disciplines that are so completely different than mine, mm-hmm. in disciplines that I would generally know nothing about. And so podcasting is also just a really fun way to explore science and appreciate science.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So is this, I know that Hooked on Science is part of my degree program. Is this part of your degree, or is this just your extracurricular for fun activity?
This is just my extra time, my little side project and gift to the world, I like to think of it as. But yeah, it was something that I thought about for a really long time. And I had been involved in science communication to some extent before. You know, I'm really lucky that there is a graduate student-led group at Northwestern called the Science Policy Outreach Task Force, or SPOT, that, you know, is made up of a lot of dedicated people that are really like-minded to me and you, and think things like science communication and science advocacy are really important. And that was a big support system that I needed to just get involved in science communication at all. And so my foray into all of this was doing more traditional outreach programs. Sure. A shout out to the Science with Seniors program at SPOT. We give, or I help coordinate graduate students that go to local senior centers in the Chicago and Evanston areas to give science talks. And that's just been a wonderfully rewarding experience. And I wanted to get involved in science communication even more beyond that, but I figured out pretty quickly that writing is not my forte. And that's a lot of what the natural next steps into science communication can be, right? Especially as an individual, it's, you know, the easiest option is just to like write an op-ed or start a blog or something like that.
Yeah, definitely.
And yeah, that just didn't really appeal to me. And like I said, podcasting was always kind of on the bucket list. And I really like it as a medium because it nicely balances, you know, having conversational, you know, more digestible chats about science. But then, you know, it's a different medium. It's a little bit, you know, comes with unique challenges more so than writing. And so it pushes me in new ways too, which I think is a fun benefit to all of this.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Compared to other science communication projects, like your project with doing outreach with seniors and other, you know, maybe one-off things that you may have done before, what have you learned the most from podcasting as a science communication medium?
That's a good question. I'm going to have to think about it for a second.
My brain was like, that's a great question. I also don't know the answer to that question.
That's how you know it's a great question.
I mean, I just thought of something. I guess I could go first and say that I think that just getting the science to the intended audience is really hard. It's not easy to, I mean, if you don't have like a big platform to promote it to people, it can be really hard to get it to anyone who you want to listen, even if you have, you know, the best intentions of trying to get it out into the world. But I think that's like the biggest barrier I've learned, or barrier I've had, and something that I'm still trying to figure out how to get people to listen and how to even just reach people before they even start listening.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. The other thing that I've learned just generally throughout being involved in more science communication efforts, but especially through the podcast, is that science communication skills do not come naturally. There's this weird assumption in academia that, you know, if you know your science, then you can communicate your science. And that is absolutely not the case. I mean, how many times have you been to a conference presentation that just totally did not get the point across and you left it being more confused than when you started? Or read a scientific paper that had a great idea but just was hard to follow or too jargony or whatever it is. Just because you know your science doesn't mean you can talk about your science well, even to other scientists, but especially to non-scientists. And so another reason why I've really, really loved podcasting specifically is because it's helping me build connections with other scientists. And I feel like I'm also, you know, having an effect on them and helping them practice their science communication skills. The more practice, the better, right? Like, it doesn't come naturally. You have to practice. And so podcasting is a fun medium. It's nice to be able to practice speaking about your work. But then also, Julia, like you and I have said, it's not TV or something too crazy, or public speaking or something too crazy, because you can go back and edit it a little bit and give yourself a little help sometimes. So
yeah,
it's a fun medium to practice with.
I agree. And I think it's also a little different. Even if people have nailed down how to talk about their science in person or in certain contexts, moving to this digital platform can be kind of hard for some people. I mean, I've noticed, at least in what I've done recording with people, it's like, oh, I've seen you talk plenty of times, but I see how nervous you are to now move to this medium that you're not used to. And so that's, I think it's a new learning experience for a lot of people. And I mean, at this point, we're a year and a half into many things being digital at this point and doing things online. So I think people are getting more comfortable with, you know, talking about their research from their kitchen table, as opposed to being like, okay, I'm going to put on my dress clothes and I'm going to go stand at this podium with my PowerPoint. And this is a little different. It requires some other skills because you don't have things like visual aids to help you along, and you have to learn how to talk about things a little bit differently. And I know I have certainly not nailed down that art and science, but I mean, I think we're all still working on it a little bit.
Yeah, the more practice you can get, the better. And just like you said, every medium comes with unique challenges and unique ways that it pushes you. And so podcasting is something that, at least in terms of being a guest on a podcast, it's not something that a lot of people have easy access to. And so being that opportunity for people to practice in a new way, in a new format, is really fun and really rewarding to see.
Yeah, I completely agree. So is there anything in particular you want to highlight for in the Spotlight Season 2? By the time this comes out, you'll be well on your way into it. Again, I have an episode as a guest on In the Spotlight that will be out the same day as this episode. What else is there to look forward to?
There's so much to look forward to. I feel like season one was kind of like still learning the ropes and kind of figuring things out a little bit. But now season two, things are like coming together a little bit more. So we have collaborations, like our crossover episode with you. I have a new host on the show, which is really fun. Nicholas Scrutin-Alvarado, shout out to him for not only doing an awesome episode in season one, but wanting to come back for more. So he and I are splitting up some of the episodes, which just helps us, you know, find and reach even more people and provide even more content, which I'm very excited about. And I think some of the topics that I've already recorded and will be coming out earlier in season two are going to be so, so excellent, including the episode that Julia did, of course. But we're also going to cover things like electrochemistry and, you know, the neuroscience of decision making and decarbonization and all sorts of things that, you know, maybe have been on your mind and maybe haven't, maybe are completely new to you. And both of those ways are very exciting. So,
yeah. And if I am not providing enough cool science research, then In the Spotlight is definitely a great option for another podcast to add to your list. Yeah, go hit subscribe and hit subscribe here too if you haven't done that. I think that we are coming to the end of our conversation today. Emily, are there any last takeaway points that you want to hit on before we finish up, either about your PhD work or about science communication in general? Whatever you want.
Yeah, I guess I'll stick to some of this science communication stuff that we've been talking about. I mean, one of the big things that I want to leave your listeners with is that reminder that public engagement with science is all of our responsibilities as scientists. So how are you participating? Is it just having conversations with your friends and family? Because that definitely matters. Is it something bigger? Is it trying other mediums like we were talking about? Writing an op-ed when you feel really inspired? You know, taking a class on science communication practices or a workshop. Just how are you being a part of public engagement with science and really helping make sure that science has a strong footing in our society? And also, I want to add that practice makes perfect. Don't assume that you have good science communication practices just because you know your science. I mean, that's something that I've experienced time and time again. I'm pretty sure most people who have dipped their toe into the water of science communication can also empathize with as well. So practice makes perfect. Don't be afraid to put yourself out there. Yeah.
Awesome. So if people want to either learn more about your research, or if they want to get in touch with you, or they want to hear more about the podcast, those are three big things, but how can they do that?
Yeah, I feel like Twitter has become my little home base for announcements and where you can stay in touch with me specifically. So my personal handle is at Sci with Emily, S-C-I with Emily, E-M-I-L-Y. And then you can also follow the podcast. It's at Spotlight the Pod. That's where most of my announcements and everything are just ramblings on my personal Twitter, I guess, get shared. You can also find In the Spotlight on, you know, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, all the major platforms. And if you're curious to learn more about the Science Policy Outreach Task Force, which is the student group that supports me and help putting on my podcast, you can learn more about our group at our website, spot.northwestern.edu.
Awesome. And I will include all those links in the episode description if you are wanting to follow those. But Emily, thank you for joining me today to talk about your research on biosensors and your science communication project. It has been a wonderful time.
Thank you so much for having me, Julia. It's been so lovely to talk to you about my work and so lovely to interview you too. I'm so glad we were able to connect.
Yes. Awesome. If you want to follow Hooked on Science on social media, you can do that on Facebook and Instagram by searching at Hooked on Science Pod, and on Twitter by searching at Hooked on Science. Thanks for listening.